My brief for today is answering the question, can Marxism explain racial, sexual and gender oppression? And actually the short answer to that question is yes, as I hope you're not surprised to hear, because hopefully you want to actually hear how Marxism can explain these things. But you know, more to the point, Marxism actually can explain oppression, because Marxism is a theory that explains class society, and oppression is firmly rooted in the class-divided nature of capitalism. And it exists, and this is a central argument that I'm going to return to in my talk, oppression exists only because of the exploitation that lies at the heart of capitalism, that is, you know, the absolute core of a capitalist system. So not only can Marxism explain oppression, though, but it is the key to ending it, because if we can understand oppression, where it comes from and how it operates, then obviously I think that means that we can understand actually how to challenge it. And the whole point of Marxism is not to just understand that we live in a brutal, exploitative and oppressive system, but how can we actually get rid of capitalism and replace it with a society of equality and freedom for all. So hopefully, you know, this talk will be a bit of a guide for that as well. So capitalism, as I said, it's a class society. So that doesn't just mean in the narrowest terms that there are haves and have-nots, you know, although of course this is true, but rather it really means that the people with wealth and privilege in capitalism have gotten their wealth through the exploitation of the vast majority of people in society. All systems of class rule that have existed throughout history have required oppression. And this really makes sense, because if you live in a society where there's a minority of people at the top of society, how else could they really, you know, uphold this injustice that they're the ones who, you know, benefit from all the resources of society and so on without some way of, you know, enforcing inequality and misery for the rest of us? Exploitation, that's the kind of key characteristic of this particular kind of class system that we live in, of capitalism. Profits, which power the system, wouldn't exist if bosses didn't steal the labour of workers. That is, you know, pay us much less in wages than the value that our work actually creates for them. Workers are economically coerced into selling our labour, because if we don't work, we don't eat, we can't pay our rent or our mortgages, and, you know, and so on and so forth. Capitalism's a little different to other class societies that have existed before it. Systems like feudalism, for instance, in which the lower classes were simply the property of the feudal lord, and which tended to rely much more on just, you know, everyday brute force to bulwark or support the rule of the minority. Of course, capitalists still rely on force to defend their system when their rule is challenged. Then, you know, they've been more than prepared to actually throw off their veneer of democracy and all of that, and actually resort to violence to uphold, you know, their system. But the capitalists, and especially in the liberal democracies, don't rule primarily by force. Key to maintaining social order and enforcing acceptance and compliance with the status quo is an extensive ideological apparatus that, you know, propagates pro-capitalist ideas. Institutions and idea-peddling individuals like the media, liberal journalists, the academia of the idea factories, the universities, the mass education system more broadly, political parties, the church and the family. And these institutions and individuals actually act like, you know, satellite dishes, I guess, pumping out and transmitting these ideas throughout society. And this is nothing really new, actually. Marx and Engels wrote way back in 1845 in what they call the German ideology, that the ideas of the ruling class are in every age the ideas of the ruling ideas. So what are the ruling ideas of capitalism then? Well, you know, sure that we can come up with a lot of them here. That competition, war and racism are, you know, products of human nature. That women have always been subordinate to men. You know, that we're just more nurturing and therefore we're best fitted for the roles of childcare or domestic labour. And importantly, that revolutions always end in tyranny and dictatorship, so there's no point actually trying to fight for a better world, because you'll just get something that's just as crap as capitalism. All of these are the ideas that put the blame for society's ills on ordinary people, not the way capitalism is actually structured to uphold the power and privilege of a tiny minority. And there are ideas that, again, you know, assert that any struggle to get rid of these things will always end in something worse. But underneath all of that ideology, you know, all of the high school textbooks that we're forced to digest, the Age editorials, lies the reality that capitalism, you know, despite sometimes the rhetoric that our leaders can have of being for democracy, liberty and equality, is really all about liberty and opportunity for the capitalist class, not the whole of society. And definitely not blacks or women or, you know, any other oppressed group in capitalism whose oppression was absolutely central to the establishment of this economic system and whose oppression remains central today. So now I'm going to move on to use some examples to actually prove that point, that capitalism was not only, that oppression was not only structured into capitalism from its very inception, from its beginnings, but that is actually used today as a way of upholding that unequal state of affairs, that class system of capitalism. I don't have time to look at every single different form of oppression, you know, in society, or all of the different groups that are oppressed. But I want to say something briefly. It's not just, you know, the groups that are in the title, you know. There's not just racial, sexual and gender oppression. Actually, all workers in society are oppressed as well as exploited in capitalism. We have different lives, horizons, living conditions, standards of healthcare, you know, schools than the rich. So, you know, you just have to look at the amount of funding that goes towards private education versus public education to really see that in practice. And of course, there are sections of the working class that are also specifically oppressed in capitalism, as well as women and gays and lesbians, disabled people, for instance, and the elderly, pensioners. They also experience oppression in capitalism too, because that, you know, their oppression sort of stems from the fact that they're not viewed as productive, you know, workers anymore in the system. They're not making profits for the bosses, so really they're just a drag. They're, you know, expendable, really, and a drain on society. Children are also oppressed, you know, to give another example of a group that that wasn't in the title. They're considered the property of their parents. Their whole experience is of having to submit to the authority of the adults in their lives at home, but also at school under their teachers, as they're prepared by these institutions to, you know, accept the kind of capitalist authority that's going to rule their lives for the whole rest of their, you know, experience. So, you know, that's just a small point about, you know, oppression actually not just being limited to the groups I'm going to talk about today. But I want to get on to what I think is, you know, one of the main points that I want to make today, which is that there is an absolute direct link between a profit-driven system of capitalism and oppression. And to use that, I'm going to start off with talking about racism. And I'm going to use the example of the history of this country that we're in today, Australia, a colonial settler state established in 1788 as an outpost for British Empire and on stolen Aboriginal land, as I'm sure we all know. Australian capitalism was founded on genocide and dispossession of Aboriginal people. Was backed up and legitimised from the beginning by gross racism and the sort of paternalism ensconced in the idea that, you know, white settlers and missionaries could play a role in, you know, civilising the native population here. So when the white settlers arrived in Australia, they found that they had invaded a world very different to their own. Aboriginal people lived in relative harmony with the land. Collective social relations were expressed via relationship to land and key sites. But these ties weren't thought of in terms of, you know, ownership or private property, like the contrast under capitalism. Aboriginal society was egalitarian, so you know, the whole kind of idea that in that society there should be some people who got to dominate and exploit others actually struck Aboriginal people as really irrational when they started to encounter it. And a Victorian clergyman, an early settler to Australia, wrote, and I think it's the quote that sums it up, that it was difficult to get into a black fellow's head that one man is higher than another. And he was commenting on the fact that actually if one Aboriginal labourer was paid more than another for being more efficient or, you know, working more days in the week or whatever, they would immediately go back to their kin and share their payment. They wouldn't just say, oh, I've done, you know, the more work than everyone else, so I'm going to keep these spoils for myself. So that shows how, you know, how different the kind of system of capitalism was compared to what existed here before. From the 1820s, the development of the pastoral industry actually saw Australian capitalism expand and start to expand more rapidly. And this required an absolute systematic and brutal strategy for stealing Aboriginal land. So the settlers were armed and authorised by the governors to use guns against blacks. And of course there was resistance from Aboriginal people, but this resistance actually ended up being brutally crushed. And, not only were Indigenous people murdered, but they were also forced to submit themselves to the mission system, whereby, Christian missionaries assimilated blacks into capitalist society by severing their connections with the land, by actually doing away with the right for Indigenous people to actually speak their own languages, and basically trying to wipe out Aboriginal culture and promoting all of the attendant racist ideas that, blacks needed to be civilised and lifted from idleness and made industrious and useful members of the new society. So the point is that land theft, denigration and destruction of culture and traditional ways of living was necessary to impose a new hierarchical structure on society, because private property, wage labour, the idea that you had to work receive a pay to be able to be a productive member of society or to get what you needed, the drive to kind of accumulate capital and, make profits, which was fundamental and is fundamental to capitalism, were incompatible with Aboriginal society. So anti-Aboriginal racism was absolutely structured into Australian society from its very beginnings. And the racism that justified dispossession actually remains important still for Australian capitalism today. Central, really. The first form of racism in Australia was useful for Australia's rulers in that it actually helped in another way, not just to get control of the land and, be able to impose the economic relations of capitalism, but that it actually helped draw up the ground rules for how you could conduct, society more broadly. So once racism towards one section of society was entrenched, it became established that a group of people or a race could be singled out for special treatment, that they could be paid lower wages, or in the case of Aboriginal people, they could work for no wages, as was the case for a whole lot of the history and actually is now becoming the reality of life for Aboriginal people today. They could be made subject to rigid government control and demonised in the media and in other public forums, on the basis of race. So in other words, racism wasn't just about creating a set of ideas. It was actually starting to become structured into the institutions of the system. And one clear example of this, I think, is the police force. The material reality of racial oppression means that black people are more likely to be arrested and jailed for minor offences, more likely to be killed when they're in custody, in police custody. And the violence that the cops use against blacks routinely is reinforced by the fact that the police assume that they'll be held less responsible than they would be with whites for their treatment of Aboriginal people. And they do it and they get away with it because actually they are held less accountable. So if you just look at the example of Chris Hurley, the cop who killed Aboriginal man Doomadgee on Palm Island in 2004 whilst he was in police custody. Well, this cop, he got a promotion for his brutal act of murder on this Aboriginal man. He actually now has a cushy office in the Gold Coast. Hardly suffering for his crime, he got a promotion. But the whole point of the police force is to enforce the property rights of the ruling class by harassing all of those who don't own property, the poor people in society, the working class, picking on the most vulnerable sections. Attacking immigrants or Aboriginals flows naturally and is all in a day's work for members of that institution. And the oppression of Australia's Indigenous population is easily transferred to other ethnic groups, immigrants and refugees, for instance. So in today's Australia, we are constantly being told that our biggest threat or one of our biggest threats or problems is refugees or illegals who we apparently have no room for in this country, who are going to, drive down our wages, take over all of our parks in Melbourne so we won't be able to go to parks or anything like that. And they just, all these people, they just want a free ride. It's, so easy for them coming to Australia and getting a free ride. The implication of all of this is, of course, well, this is the, main problem in society. These people who are coming from abroad, and they're to be feared and derided, and they actually want to attack all of our, lives. And this racism links back actually to a whole chain of immigrants from different backgrounds in Australia. Actually, when I was growing up in Australia, it wasn't really the group that was most attacked wasn't actually Muslim immigrants. It was actually Vietnamese immigrants who would supposedly take all of our jobs and refuse to assimilate into Australian society. This was in the 1980s, and this shows, I think, the continued usefulness of racism for the ruling class in Australian capitalism. Because the point of all of these ideas are, of course, to encourage workers to vent their frustrations, not on big business or, the governments who actually uphold the interests of, those businesses, but on other victims of capitalism who are actually even weaker, seem even weaker and more vulnerable than ourselves. If the government can establish racist attitudes towards foreigners, well, then they can create scapegoats and deflect attention from the real problems in society. That it's not immigrants that are the problem, but actually governments that refuse to fund public housing and welfare, whilst they pump billions of dollars into the defence budget and the war on Afghanistan. Bosses who want to get away with paying their employees slave wages, cutting conditions and smashing union organisation in our workplaces. In short, the bosses, the people at the top of society, that's the problem. And of course, it's also very useful to our rulers if their targets are constantly vilified and attacked in the media as, terrorists and illegals. If they're segregated or isolated, forced to live in kind of ethnic ghettos, if you think of like the western suburbs of Melbourne, or concentration camps if you're a refugee, and preferably nowhere near mainland Australia, 3,000 kilometres off the mainland at Christmas Island, because, this is actually the way that the government and the media can keep all of the stereotypes and racism about refugees alive, is if no Australian worker actually can or finds it very difficult to confront the actual human face of refugees. And it's for this reason that you can't separate out oppression from the class exploitation that lies at the very core of the capitalist system. Because oppression is, as I hope, that sort of shows, a critical tool that the ruling class have at their disposal to ensure the sort of stability of their system. And some people, I guess, might say that this sounds like a little conspiratorial, or is it a little far-fetched to say that, really, governments and capitalists, they've just, planned all of this out, that they just sit down and map out how to use racism to divide us up or to screw Aboriginal people out of their land, and so on. So it's not quite the case that every morning the, bosses or the heads of government sit down around a table. Well, they do this every morning, but they don't, necessarily just sit there and exactly map out these things. Now we're going to attack this particular community or whatever. But the reality is that racist ideas, because they're grounded firmly in the logic of capitalist rule, actually have some kind of logic for our rulers that gets carried out. So mining rights for corporations in Australia, the mining bosses, key section of Australian capital, well, their rights can't to, make more profit to exploit the land. Those rights don't go along, really, with collective ownership of the land or Aboriginal people actually controlling their land, do they? So today, that means that keeping Australian capitalism profitable and keeping the heads of the mining corporations happy and keeping their profits rolling in actually goes with government takeovers of Aboriginal land, like the Northern Territory intervention. It goes with, Aboriginal people being forced to lease their land for the purposes of waste dumps being built on them, or, so that they can actually, continue to mine on that land. And it also goes along with a so-called justice system, the courts, the police force and so on, that's actually about defending this state of affairs and those rights for capitalism. And actually, on the other hand, governments do have a long history of consciously fostering, I would say, racist ideas to legitimise their agendas. So it's not just like, it's just, the logic that gets played out and they bear no responsibility for, fostering this divide and rule in society. Actually, an example of that, I think the best example by far, is the War on Terror, which absolutely required the creation of, anti-Muslim bigotry on a scale that had not existed, previously. Think of like the countless hours that must have gone into writing university courses in terrorism studies or, democracy versus terrorism or whatever. I did a course like that at Melbourne Uni some years ago at the beginning of the War on Terror. Not to mention the kind of legal infrastructure to enforce the war on terror, the anti-terror laws, the creation of government anti-terrorism task squads, the manufacturing of all of the stereotypes that have just become common sense in the media, that, you know, Muslim men beat their wives, that, you know, Islam is, you know, inherently an oppressive, set of ideas, that anyone who wears the veil or practices Islam is, you know, some fundamentalist that's a, you know, threat to democracy. And of course, as well, the jailing in Australia of the requisite number of Australian homegrown terrorists, like Jack Thomas or the Barwon 13, to actually just prove that all of that money and all of that effort was really well spent, because, you know, really there is this, you know, big threat from Muslims. And why did the government go to, and, you know, the media and everything go to all of this trouble? Well, it was absolutely to justify the government's agenda of support for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which actually, you know, in the case of the war in Iraq, a majority of people in Australia actually opposed from its very outset. So this ideology is very important to actually, you know, perpetuating the agenda of the ruling class. And it's also the case that bosses know how to shore up their system, and they know that a divided working class can only sort of be an asset to them. So they do deliberately foster division between workers. And I think one example of this is of the Ford Broadmeadows factory in the 1970s. If people know a bit about the Ford factory in Broadmeadows, there was a strike there in the 1970s. Well, anyway, there was a strike basically because of the horrific conditions at this factory. But it was a factory which had a workforce comprised of 75% of workers from non-English speaking backgrounds. And management actually there very consciously exploited the different language barriers and ethnic divisions between Greek, Italian, Turkish and other workers. And they purposely constructed a production line. So you think of, like, in a car factory, people have to take their position in the line and help, you know, assemble parts or whatever. And they actually consciously set up a production line where no one who spoke the same language was actually, no worker could actually stand next to someone who spoke the same language as them on the line. And in the words of a Ford factory spokesman, this was about an official procedure not to create ghettos. And he said, we try to mix them up so that each section represents the workplace as a whole to get them used to a multicultural society. But, you know, which, yeah, you think, but, you know, the policy was clearly aimed at making it totally impossible for workers to, you know, be part of a society and actually learn to have communication between other workers and so on, because they were individualised. And it was all about making it very difficult for the workers to be able to coordinate industrial action and actually fight against the horrendous conditions in that plant, which actually meant that workers had to beg. There was no right to toilet breaks. Workers had to beg the foreman to, could I please go to the toilet? Or, you know, they were subject to work speed ups all the time and so on by the bosses. So the bosses actually do know that, you know, racism is very useful to them. But it's clearly not just blacks and immigrants who suffer oppression in capitalism. As I said, there's a whole range of groups within the working class that are specifically oppressed. And sexism and homophobia also help bolster the ruling class. And the origins of these ideas and, you know, how can you explain them actually lies, again, in the exploitative nature of capitalism. Divisions between men and women, you know, have existed before capitalism, but the capitalist system actually specifically moulded them to suit capitalist rule. The nuclear family has been a central institution in capitalism. It has ensured that all of the work that goes into raising the next generation of workers is privatised within the home, and it's ensured the bosses a steady supply of future workers to exploit free of charge, with also, you know, women largely doing a lot of the unpaid labour that's involved in that process. And maintaining the centrality of the nuclear family has involved mass state intervention into women's lives. So historically, women's sexuality had to be repressed so as to force them to accept the restrictions of monogamy and their subservient role in the household. But, you know, since the middle of the 20th century, it hasn't been the case that, you know, women, the main role that women play in society is just, you know, in the home, you know, as domestic, you know, labourers or anything like that. Actually, most women today, 70% are in paid employment. So most women, most of us, actually part of the paid workforce. But the capitalists try to maintain the gender roles that have been constructed over centuries and perpetuated through the family. So this has led to most women actually having to take on a double burden as both workers and primary caregivers in the home. And at the same time, all of the stereotypes and ideological conceptions of women that are spawned by the family, that women are uniquely fitted to do the, you know, the jobs, the cleaning, the, you know, feeding of children and so on, because they're more nurturing than men and so on, actually reinforce the ability of the bosses to underpay women workers. So if you take into account, women workers in full employment, actually women still only earn 83% of men's wages. And that, like, reduces drastically when you actually take into account women who are not just in full employment, who are in part-time or casualised jobs. So we can see, again, it's not just a case that women are subject to, you know, like, sexist ideas about, you know, about their, what, you know, a woman's role should be like, but these attitudes are actually structured into society with benefit to our exploiters. And this sexism also flows through to the type of work that women are concentrated in. So women actually make up the majority of casual employees. About 45% of women work in casual jobs to about 14% of men. And, you know, historically it was under the cover of the rhetoric of, you know, family values that it became easy for our ruling class to assert that casualisation was good, you know, a good thing to have introduced into the workforce, because, of course, this allows for more flexibility for women to be able to pick up their kids from school or, you know, do employment while they have children and so on. And the benefit to the employers is clear. They actually have managed to get away with denying a significant portion of the workforce conditions and benefits that have actually paved the way for the casualisation of more and more workers' jobs. And it's also the case that all workers in women-dominated industries, like teaching, public health, nursing, which are associated with the expected gender roles of women in capitalism, have also been subject to worse pay. So although capitalism sort of changed over time, this hasn't done away with, you know, the fact that women are oppressed in that society, that we have sexism. But it's just actually changed the way, some of the ways in which women have experienced it. And the double burden is just one example of this. So with regards to sexuality, for instance, you know, gone are the kind of constraints prevalent in the 1950s about, you know, women's expectation that women would suppress their sexuality, you know, cover up and be chaste and so on. Today, these standards have been replaced by the expectation that women are, you know, sexual beings who should be, you know, not sexual beings for their own pleasure, but who should be sexually available and make themselves attractive to men. Yet it's still the case, on the other hand, that women who are sexually confident or who, you know, assert their sex lives or whatever are labelled as sluts. You know, that's still the common perception of women in the media and so on. You just have to look at, you know, all of the so-called sex scandals around the AFL and so on, which are actually rape scandals in the large part to show how these stereotypes have changed, but still equally oppressive towards women, or the standards about women's sexuality. And these standards and stereotypes are reinforced in the media and advertising, and we're socialised into them as well. I think that's the other aspect, through our interactions with the family. And they pervade every aspect of women's lives, including the ways in which women and men actually interact under capitalism. So a study that was released last year that was based on interviews with managers, it was actually released at the end of 2009, so, you know, a little less recent than last year, but that it was based a study that was that interviewed managers from Australia's top 13 companies, and often, like, you know, they try and you know, researchers try and interview, like, the boards of directors or whatever to get some sense of, like, the attitudes towards women or whatever in society. And actually, on one level, I think it's very useful, because it generally is that the people at the top sitting in these boardrooms and so on actually are the indication of the, you know, sexism that exists towards women in society. They actually interviewed these people, and that study showed that male executives are, you know, lo and behold, more likely to hire men who they think exhibit leadership qualities for, you know, higher paid positions. They consistently stated in the report's words that the perceived reluctance of women interviewees to enter into a game of aggressive personal politics showed weakness and a lack of ambition, which in turn made them less, you know, employable and desirable as employees. But in another indication of how the double standards flow through, women who were confident in the interviews were, the manager said, they encouraged suspicion and division, so they weren't really good candidates either. So it just seems if you're a woman, basically you're fucked. You can't win either way, can you? And that's, you know, a perfect summary of how the oppression has, you know, those ideas have taken a hold in society. But the key thing is, like, more important than that, really, is that these attitudes, yeah, they actually, they're a symptom, they're a reflection of the fact that women are oppressed in society and of the sexism in society. But they don't just, like, fall out of the sky, like, they don't just materialise in and of themselves. They are underpinned by the fact that women are unequal in capitalism. That, you know, we're paid lower wages, that we're subject to worse conditions at work, that we're treated less seriously. So it's not surprising then that both men and women act as if they're not equals, you know, as if we're not equals of men and accept, you know, the sexist ideas and so on. And this is kind of similar. I'm not going to talk at length about how people take up or accept the ideas, but I think it's worth making at least a couple of points on that. It's similar to how racist ideas become accepted, because they actually seem to accord with a reality in some cases about the way capitalism looks and how it's actually run. So today, for instance, because of racism, Aboriginal people are overrepresented in jail, live in substandard, you know, conditions in remote communities. And so the ideas that the ideologues push, that, you know, blacks are backwards, and, you know, they require saving from themselves or whatever, actually can seem to accord to some, you know, reality of how the world looks. So a report from the Western Australian government, actually, on Indigenous housing, which was published in 2009, found that Indigenous housing, when it was built, because it's often, obviously it's not built, but when it did exist, it was built using substandard building materials in WA. So, you know, not termite resistant and so on. So actually, when those buildings fall apart, this actually helps to create an opportunity for the government bureaucracy and the media to point to and assert, you know, see these Indigenous people, they don't look after their homes, they can't be trusted, you know, when they're given resources or whatever. They're incapable of providing for their children's safety and welfare and so on. So actually, the point that I'm making is that oppression and inequality in society creates a set of facts that helps reinforce bigoted attitudes in society and the ideas. So workers and students might take up, you know, these oppressive or bigoted ideas, but we actually know where they come from. They come from capitalism. They come from the system. And the gender roles created for women by capitalism and institutionalised in the family actually slide into another form of oppression, that of homophobia. And since, you know, since maintaining the ideal of the nuclear family also requires demonising any kind of sexual or social relationship outside of heterosexuality. And so, you know, not only is it that, you know, the capitalism relies on women's unpaid labour in the family to kind of raise a new generation of workers and actually do all of that work for free for the state, but it also relies on the ideal of the family to indoctrinate people with the same kind of gender roles and norms and behaviours that, you know, are prevalent throughout capitalism. And actually, the family is an incredibly effective way of getting people to accept that this is the way of the world, that, you know, women and men are unequal and so on, because it's actually the people closest to you who seem to be sort of, you know, socialising you into these ideas. And again, just as with sexism, homophobic ideas are reinforced for individuals by people's everyday experience of life under capitalism. So, you know, this is an experience where heterosexual relationships are glorified on TV and in the media, where images of homosexuality are kept out of schools so that kids don't learn about, you know, homosexual families or whatever. And actually it becomes normalised so that children actually feel at ease to kind of, you know, slag off about gay families or, you know, to think that there's something different about people who choose to live their lives or, you know, who choose this sexual preference, because it does seem out of the ordinary or not normal and strained given all of the kind of education that they receive and so on. And the benefits of sexism and homophobia for the capitalist class, well, they're not just reducible to the unpaid labour in the home or the drag that sexism actually creates on wages. Oppression is also about social control. And that's the last point I want to make about how oppression is really useful to our rulers. Because homophobia and sexism do hold workers back. Gender stereotypes undermine women and make us feel underconfident. If people don't feel like we can have control over the most intimate parts of our lives, you know, who we can sleep with, if the state can dictate who we can marry, which relationships are legitimate, and so on, this actually just makes it harder for people to see how they can fight for a better state of affairs in any area of their lives. You know, is that it worth, you know, to fight for, you know, better wages or whatever, or to oppose things that are, you know, bigger than just individuals in society, like the fact that, you know, there are these disgusting wars, you know, raging in the world, or, you know, or oppression more broadly or whatever. So I guess then I want to sum up now. What's my time?
34.
Okay. Well, I want to sum up now, actually, by coming back to some of those things that I started with, actually. That oppression is key to cementing and upholding the rule of a minority in the class system of capitalism. Because workers' power, you know, to actually change society comes from our ability to unite, to come together and organise, to actually fight for a better world. If we're ground down, if we're separated, if we're atomized, if we think that the real problem isn't, you know, our rulers, but it's, you know, my, you know, someone over there who's a refugee, or, you know, someone who's, you know, in a gay relationship or whatever, well, then actually our actual power as a class to actually make a better world is undermined, to be united and see who our real enemies are. So this is why the ruling class is keen on fostering divisions among our working people. It undermines our capacity to collectively struggle for better lives, better wages, and ultimately for a decent, humane society that's free of all of the poverty and brutality and oppression and war of capitalism. So rather than just affecting a particular, you know, group of people in the working class or whatever, actually oppression actually means that the whole of the working class can be more effectively exploited. And so because capitalism is a necessary inbuilt part, because oppression is a necessary inbuilt part of capitalism, we're never going to really be free of racism, sexism, or homophobia until we get rid of capitalism. But so long as, ordinary people do accept oppressive ideas and allow our bosses and our governments to divide us, well, that will make it a hell of a lot harder for us to build the kind of united, strong movement that we need to get rid of capitalism. So revolutionaries are the most determined fighters against oppression in the here and now, which comes back to a bit about how do we actually challenge this oppression. We're not just waiting around till a revolution to challenge oppression in the system. We know that there's a real dynamic relationship between the stances that we take in here and now against oppression and, you know, an ultimate struggle to get rid of capitalism. Such struggles, you know, for gay marriage rights or for refugee rights in the here and now are a blow against capitalism because they're actually attacking some of the ways in which our rulers do maintain their rule. And they also show ordinary people that fighting back, taking a stand together alongside workers, whatever their ethnic, racial or social background may be, is actually how we can fight for a better world for all of us. And so they actually create solidarity and unity between us and break down some of those divisions. Not only do we sort of want to be in those campaigns and struggles and participate in those fights against oppression, but we want to build an organisation in the here and now to actually win ordinary people away from bigoted ideas which hold all of us back. And, you know, such an organisation really, you know, of some size, I mean, we already, Social Solidarity already is involved in those kind of campaigns against oppression and so on in the here and now. But if we had a, you know, more sizable organisation, well, we could argue in every single situation, on every campus, in every workplace that exists in Australia, for actually solidarity between ordinary people to actually point out who are the real enemy in our society, you know, the bosses, and actually to draw together the connections between fighting for workers' rights, gay rights, fighting racism, and actually fighting for a better, more equal world for all of us, free of the exploitation of the system that we live in today.